Welcome to our third segment of this afternoon's program. It is Sunday, the 13th of February, 2022. It is now 2:33 p.m. in the studio. I'm your host, Kieran Murdoch. Our aim in this discussion is to explore the issue of bribery or hush money and other forms of perverting justice or concealing wrongdoing when it comes to sex crimes. The case which has given rise to this discussion is the case of a former police officer and another man who are accused of bribing a sexual assault survivor to drop a case against the former officer. We often hear of these arrangements or attempts at making them when we discuss sex crimes, whether they are initiated by the accused, the alleged victim, or any of their representatives. In today's discussion, which is going to be pretty brief, just around half an hour, we won't be discussing exclusively the specific case, and many persons would have read about it, and they read the Daily Observer, which I do encourage you to do. But we'll be talking more broadly about the issue of trying to exchange silence for some form of benefit. So our question is, how serious is the issue of bribery and or hush money when it comes to sex crimes and efforts to escape criminal justice? Joining our panel for this discussion will be we are happy to have with us Ms. Naima Hazel. She is Deputy Director of the National Counseling Center in St. Kitts. Ms. Hazel has studied sociology and psychology and specializes in gender and race and obtained both her bachelor's and her master's in the fields of psychology from the University of the West Indies. She has over 20 years of experience working with youth communities in St. Kitts and Nevis in the areas of health and family life education, guidance and counseling, juvenile justice and NGO development. Good afternoon to you, Ms. Naima Hazel. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. Always happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Happy to have you with us. And we also have with us Ms. Shelley Sicharan. She is an attorney at law and a Trinidadian living in Barbados. She's been a lawyer for almost 14 years and is called to the bar in Trinidad and Tobago, Barbados, Antigua and Barbuda, and Dominica. She has also worked on cases in St. Lucia and Grenada and has appeared before the Caribbean Court of Justice. Happy to have her with us this afternoon, attorney at law, Ms. Shelley Sicharan. I hope I've pronounced the last name correctly, Ms. Sicharan. Still muted on Zoom there, if you are with us.
Perfectly, Kieran. Good afternoon to you and to everybody listening in Antigua. I'm happy to be here.
Ms. Naima Hazel, just having taken a look at the story, which was in our news this week, and it's a story we've been following. It has come up and in the news again and again, as our court reporter has followed it throughout the last few months. But that issue, that actual issue of a criminal matter arising out of somebody attempting to offer some form of benefit, whether money or something else, in exchange to an alleged victim of a sexual crime. Is that something you have seen often? Is it something you've seen before? What sort of insight could you give us into how serious a matter this is and how often it is something that you may see in your experience?
Okay, I'll tell you what I don't often see, the prosecution, which I'm sure that our lawyer will agree. You don't often see the prosecution of persons who offer money to victims of sexual violence or violence. But the act of offering the bribe, very, very common. In fact, I can't think of too many situations where I do not see it, especially working, you know, I work with as an advocate as well for victims, for sexual victims through our center, and it's almost consistent that eventually somebody will reach out. It might not be the perpetrator themselves. They'll often call somebody else, get a friend or somebody that they think is close to the person, or somebody who they think has influence over the person. But this is just so common that people offer financial bribes to get people not to press charges or to change their stories or to withdraw charges. And with the case of minors, often they offer bribes to the parents. And then the parents then accept the bribe. And sometimes the children don't even know that a bribe's been accepted, just that their case has been dropped. So this is something that I've seen often. I've even seen lawyers who come to offer a bribe to clients, which I'm sorry to say, this is something that happens so commonly and at every level before they get to court, even when they're already in court. This is a process that happens quite often. And I'm sure everybody listening who's ever been in a similar situation or heard of somebody in a similar situation knows that this is something that happens quite commonly.
And Ms. Shelley Citran, I wonder your initial take on issues like this, how often you may have seen them, and to what extent issues of legality arise. I mean, clearly in this instance, we had a situation where our Director of Public Prosecutions was clearly of the view that what had taken place was clearly illegal, something that was in an effort to subvert or avoid criminal procedure, and brought a charge of perverting the course of justice. What have you seen in terms of matters like these?
Well, I agree with Naima. I've never seen a prosecution of anybody who has offered financial compensation in a case like this. I would say that it's certainly more common than not that in offenses of this nature, there is some discussion about compensation, whether initiated by the complainant or by the accused. And I agree with her as well that it comes through family members, through friends, through people in the community. And in the matters that I've been involved in, it's always even been counsel to counsel. So sometimes the lawyers will reach out to the attorney on the other side and say, are you interested in having it dealt with this way? So I agree with her that it's quite common that, for people to discuss compensation.
Naima, I'm and I sort of want to get into this issue because there are those who would characterize an approach of this sort, well, not specifically in this case, but an approach of this sort in some instances as something legitimate between persons engaged in some manner of legal issue before the courts. I am trying to understand the extent to which it becomes illegal. Is there any legitimacy at all in terms of attempting to offer someone any benefit in order to settle a matter when it is a matter that ought to be dealt with in a criminal way? So I put that question first to Naima, and then I'll come back to Ms. Shelley Citran.
Okay, well, I think this is actually a great one for Shelley, but I think that the question you asked is actually interesting. One, of course, it's absolutely illegal. You're not allowed to pervert the course of justice. You're so supposed to allow the process to continue. A charge has come, it goes to the process to the police create a case, it goes to the prosecutor decides if there's enough case there for you to prosecute. If he decides he can prosecute the case, it should be prosecuted. Anything that perverts that course by trying to influence a witness or a victim, of course, is a perversion of justice. So, of course, it's always appropriate that charges should come forth, but usually charges don't come forth. So that's because the charges can actually come forth, not even just to the perpetrator. Sometimes it's the victim's parent. So, you know, we've had situations here in St. Kitts where you've had to charge a parent for taking a bribe for a child's case. So, like, it is a very serious crime, and I think it's just that we don't prosecute it enough.
And Ms. Citran, I would ask this again, the same question. I'm wondering if there's any issue, whether or not it's a matter that is already in criminal procedure, or whether or not it's a matter that has been filed in civil court. But you could explain to the best of your knowledge.
Well, I would say, first of all, that it's always the complainant's right to change their mind at any point and decide that they're not interested in continuing the prosecution. Otherwise, we would have a situation where, having made a complaint, you are forced to continue with the criminal process, regardless of how you feel about it along the way. I would also say that there is some scope in the law for what is considered to be reasonable compensation or making good of a loss or injury. And that doesn't just apply to sexual offenses, it applies to all different kinds of offenses as well. So for example, in Barbados, even under the Arrestable Offenses Act, there's a provision that allows that to be done, the making of reasonable compensation. So I can't agree that in all cases, compensation constitutes a perversion of the course of justice or some form of witness intimidation.
But surely you would acknowledge that there's certainly a difference between, let us say, a case of assault where somebody, you know, punches me in the face and knocks my teeth out, and I seek financial compensation from them in terms of settling that matter, as compared to something as heinous as a sexual assault or even some manner of grievous sexual harassment. That mm-hmm. Surely there's certain things which ought to be directed to criminal procedure and ought not to be prevented from getting to criminal procedure by any other arrangement. What do you think?
Well, I would say that, and I'm glad we're having this discussion because I was thinking about it recently. I don't know that we should rule out compensation as a form of justice in any case, even in a case of a sexual assault, because there are quite a few instances too where the complainant is the person who has sought the compensation and feels that it is appropriate in these circumstances that it should be dealt with that way, rather than they may think subjecting themselves to the criminal process and having to relive and be re-traumatized, because it's not an easy thing for a person who has suffered an assault of this nature to go to court and have to relive it and tell it again and again to dozens of people. And they may think in these circumstances, the best approach for them is actually to have a compensation. What I would say, however, is that it may be appropriate for us to consider in the Caribbean whether there shouldn't be some protection in doing these things. So instead of removing this as an option for a victim, let's leave it on the table, but say that the person should have legal representation. And if as Naima is saying, you know, there's a minor involved, then that minor should have independent representation. Perhaps we should have these types of agreements approved by a court. Should we then put in some conditions on it? For example, we don't want that people continually buy their way out of trouble, because that's how we ended up with Harvey Weinstein in America. He was paying off all of these people who were making complaints about him for decades, and then it created a culture where he felt he could act without consequence. So should we then say, well, in reviewing something like this, it is only available for a first-time offender and only in appropriate cases? But I'm not in favor of taking away options from a victim. I'm saying we may have to put some conditions on it and bring it forward to the court and have a discussion.
Well, Ms. Naima Hazel, how would you respond to that, particularly this issue of not taking that option away? Let's say a victim would say, I don't want to go through the trauma of a criminal process, even though I believe in our system, and either of the panelists can correct me. I think pretty much the DPP can go ahead. Well, they wouldn't go ahead, obviously, if they don't have the cooperation of the complainant. But the extent to which they have, you know, the power to press the matter is quite great. But this issue of leaving it up to the victim, what do you think about that?
I think, as my colleague said, that the victim always does have a choice. You know, the process is not a nice process. It can go on for a very long period of time. And often it's the victim who is subject to being penalized in the court of public opinion. So it can be very difficult for a victim. But the distinction that I actually liked to hear, because at first I was here like, oh, no, because I see the direction it's going. But is that my colleague made was that there has to be something in the law that addresses it. So if it is an agreement that's in front of the court, then everything is up front and then people can see that's an agreement. But if I can give you an example, in St. Kitts, we recently had a case. I know we discussed it here on the radio a few months ago with a person who was accused and found guilty, and the court decided that they would give the person a suspended sentence and I think a $10,000 fine. And the public was aghast. Nobody asked the victim if she thought that that was a suitable amount of money or even if she had asked for money. And so I think that the distinctions that my colleague made are important, that there you never do want to take the right away from the victim, because it is the victim's right to deal with the matter how she wants. But there must be protections ingrained in the system, which we currently I don't see having, but are not impossible to have, protections in the system in those cases, so that there's a distinction between a civil settlement and a bribe.
I
think there has to be a distinction. And even the civil, I wish in St. Kitts that women would bring civil litigation against people who have charged them. I think that that would actually do a lot in terms of limiting our number of abusers. I actually think hitting abusers in the pocket, especially those that are prominent persons that are taking advantage of social disparities, I think would actually be quite an effective deterrent.
Ms. Shelley Cijaran, would you, for instance, as we talk about having a more stated and clear a set of rules and guidelines as to how persons who allege that they are the victims or survivors of sexual assault or harassment can go about having that dealt with, whether through a civil claim or whether through a criminal procedure. Would you suggest that if you are going to go with some manner of civil process, that apart from the rules simply being laid out, that it is a process that requires the notification of that jurisdiction's prosecutor, that it is something that the prosecutor must be aware of. So it's not going to be the case where it's something terrible and heinous that escapes the view of the prosecutorial authorities in the country because it was something that the persons involved could, you know, apply enough pressure to have settled without attracting the attention of law enforcement and the prosecutors. Would you agree to that something like that would be sensible?
Well, again, we have to be careful here because even though we're discussing sexual assault, I just want to make an analogy here. When it comes to sexual harassment, which is prevalent in our workplaces in the Caribbean, women are victimized often. Usually it's women who are victimized. And they're in a position where even though there's a formal process available, they feel that they can't utilize it. And what's interesting is in Barbados, the sexual harassment legislation criminalizes making a false complaint of sexual harassment, but sexual harassment itself is not a crime. So I don't want us to go down a road where we are going to penalize victims for not making a complaint about something. To the extent that you're suggesting that the notification should be there, I mean, I'm not saying if you file a civil complaint, then it leave it to the attorney to say, well, I filed a civil complaint against this person, but the law requires me to also serve the director of public prosecution so he's aware. But I wouldn't want a victim in those circumstances to be penalized for not making that formal complaint.
Ms. Naima Hazel, how would you respond to that?
Yeah. Additionally, also them not being penalized for not making the formal complaint, I think that we're assuming then that a civil case can come without a criminal case, and it will be very difficult for you to have a civil case for a case of sexual violation with no criminal charge that's already been pressed before that. So like, I know, like, realistically, I know what the law says, but practically, I think that my colleague would agree it'd be difficult to push a civil case without a criminal case having happened previously. That's what we've been told here in my work as an advocate. So I also agree with her that we have to be kind of careful there. Also, I feel like the idea that we think that if we put these things in place, something that you brought made me think, the idea that we think if we put these protections in place that people would use them, that's not a guarantee either. But I think that we have to be careful not to be making a conversation here to make it about civil litigation of sexual violation and not actually the bribery that's about the return for silence. Because if you're doing it through the court, it's not a silent process. You're not paying somebody money not to put a charge or for their silence. You're not asking them to sign an NDA, like a non-disclosure for their silence. You're paying them for the harm that's done to them. Maybe you put that in that contract. But I don't want us to go so far down the path that we lose sight of the discussion about the bribery that actually does happen, because most people would not be in a position to put a civil case or would not think about doing it in that legal way. That's not the experience that we're having. That is an example that we would love to have an ideal, but it's not the current experience. Otherwise, you wouldn't have this case in Antigua at this time.
Which is an interesting distinction, quite correct, in that the case that we used as a jumping off point for this discussion is one where there was a criminal process already happening, and then it was discovered, or it is alleged by the prosecutors that these individuals offered money and it was accepted in order for that person to ask that case be dropped, which is, or would the prosecutors have alleged, is an instance, a clear instance of bribery. I'll come back to you, Ms. Hazel, to ask. You mentioned as we began earlier that this sort of thing happens often. I am sort of taken back into our conversations that we've had on this program where we've spoken about the issue of transactional sex, and we've spoken about, especially when it comes to the abuse of younger persons, how often it is many other material things. It could be money towards education. It could be cell phones and electronic devices. Do you often see those sorts of things as well? It's not exclusively the offering of money, is it?
No, it's not exclusively the offering of money, and it's not even a distinction for young people. You know, adults also engage in transactional sex. In fact, we have very transactional cultures. Our politics are transactional, our business is transactional, our relationships are transactional. We've actually taught our young people that everything is transactional. And I often believe that everything in our country is are something for something. You don't get something if you don't give something. I used to be a guidance counselor, and I used to teach my kids, listen, you think you're getting it free, but after freeness is penis. And they used to laugh. What do you mean? Yes, you got that. After freeness, somebody's coming back. Eventually, they want something back for you. So there's always something for something. And I often believe that some perpetrators even think that there's a cost for a victim's dignity or their self-worth or their trauma. Like, you know, oh, well, if I just offer this, why don't you just take this money? Like, you know, you want the money. You sure you really want to push the case? So for me, the transactional nature of it just follows the cultural trends and practices that we're accustomed to, that anything can be paid for, anything can be bought. And so persons who can't afford to pay to get out of trouble, then it becomes, of course, a transactional exchange. But that, of course, reflects everything that is happening in our societies at this time.
And I think that was perhaps the concern I was more so leaning in on earlier, the idea that someone is able to pay to get themselves out of trouble, to actually put a price on them not having to go through the criminal procedure. Of course, we made the distinction, Mr. Hazel made the distinction between a formal civil case that is filed, dealt with by lawyers, where certain matters are before the court, as opposed to somebody simply giving you something without all of that formality and saying, you know, don't worry about this, please forget about it, drop the case, tell the person you don't want to go forward, which you would consider to be quite a perversion and a bribe. But to my mind, as we were discussing earlier, they seem so related in terms of just exchanging a benefit to secure the silence of that person. And I wonder if there's not a real gray area there, because, you know, the poor man on the street who commits a crime may just not go through have the presence of mind to try and hire a lawyer and try to get the other person, the alleged victim, to go through a lawyer. But let's say somebody like we mentioned Harvey Weinstein would do so. I wonder what do you think about that, Miss Shelley Sicheran, this issue of differentiating between, you know, when it's a formal civil issue and when it's an underhanded issue of perversion or bribery, when some persons would say you're still just offering a benefit to secure silence, regardless of how formal or legal it is.
I mean, the truth is that whenever we talk about money, whether it's compensation or fines in the criminal justice system, it is automatically going to favor the fellow that has more money. If you have to pay a $10,000 fine and you've got $100,000 or $1 million in your bank, it may not mean anything to you, but it may mean that the fine in the context is reasonable. I think what we want to have is an open discussion, and we don't want to create a situation where we have repeated offenders who think that they can just buy their way out, continually buy their way out. And one thing, just listening to Naima, that comes through as well, is very often these predators will pick people who are vulnerable. So they will pick a person who is in a subordinate position to them somehow or the other. They're in a position of trust and authority over that person. I thinking here about Jeffrey Epstein, for example, who deliberately preyed on very young girls who had no stability, no security, no family. And a lot of them were also bought off, if we want to put it that way. And some of their same family members encouraged that. And when we talk about perverting the course of justice and transactional sex, there are very much families who are involved in doing that kind of thing and allowing very often young vulnerable women to be victimized. So we can't create that situation. We've already had that situation in the Caribbean, and I think it's time for us to move away from it.
And Ms. Naima Hazel, I think I wonder how you'd react to this. I think that we sort of take a view that if an alleged victim is going to seek some sort of financial compensation or settlement or restitution, we tend to take a negative look. Oftentimes we can take a negative look at that, but we don't actually make it very easy to go through the actual process in the criminal procedure of alleging some manner of sexual crime and having that pushed through through a trial process. We don't make that easy, do we?
We don't. No, we don't. And you answer that question actually yourself. We just don't make it easy. And sometimes the victims are in a position where even making the report is a threat to their livelihood. Like Michelle said, it could be their job. You know, it might be their boss. It might be a person that's in a great position of power to influence their life, their child's life, their family's life. So in situations like that, and they have to weigh their options, and that's the option presented to them. But often then, as a society, we're very judgmental. So we assume that if somebody took a settlement, then that means that they're definitely guilty. You know, like it makes you think of the Michael Jackson case. You know, if you take a settlement, then people are going to assume you're guilty. You know, I just want it to go away. But we just assume, instead of us putting it on the accuser and saying, oh, they paid a settlement, so that means they must be guilty. Instead, we put it on the victim. They accepted a settlement, so that means that, oh, they're not really harmed. But it is very a difficult process to go through the courts, a very long and arduous process that I think we just have to put an ease to the process. And so that more women see more women successfully, or victims more see more successful prosecutions of persons who are committing these crimes, and also persons who are offering or accepting bribes. And then maybe we would start to see a shift in the way that we see it as a society and a public.
I'm going to throw this question to you, Ms. Hazel, before I go back to Ms. Sicharan. And I would say that every time we have conversations on these or related topics, it occurs to me that when you are responding to the issue of sexual crimes, sexual impropriety, sexual assault, sexual harassment, it is never easy and it is never perfect. The process to address it is never easy and never perfect. And so it brings me back to the issue of prevention. So my last question to you would be preventing sexual crimes, preventing persons from having to even go through this process because someone has assaulted them. When we think about prevention, what would you want to leave us with?
Wow, prevention. That's a tough one. I don't know how you stop an abuser from abusing, and I'm a therapist, you know. We like to use the good life model, you know, and we don't really understand why certain abusers abuse, or why one person would abuse given an opportunity, whereas another person wouldn't if they're not given the opportunity. There are different types of abusers, so that's a bit more complicated. Mm-hmm. But for me, I think where it is for us is that we have to start looking at making it easier, the process for women. So like one of the examples I'd like to give is for us in St. Kitts, we just started, we're working with CWIL, St. Kitts, this is a professional women's association, and the Ministries of Gender in St. Kitts and Nevis, and the National Counseling Center. We've developed a sexual victim advocacy program. So we're training women to be advocates, which is in our domestic violence legislation. And then, so when a woman is going to report, she has an advocate who knows the law, can be there to support her, that she can call if somebody offers her a bribe, somebody who's there to support you through the process, so that more women feel comfortable going through the process with somebody and some support from the system. So I think it's not realistic for us to think that predators are going to stop perpetrating, especially when so many get away with it. But we have to start making victims' needs more prevalent and make it easier for the victims who do want to report, because as my colleague said, not everybody does, and that's your right as well, that do want to report, to make that process easier for them.
Is that part of how we can prevent, though, in terms of, because we often have persons, predators, who are repeat offenders. You know, you find someone who has gotten away with doing something over and over and over when they really should have been incarcerated the first time or shot.
And victims who are repeat victims. So the predator will see that that person did a report, and so they'll target that victim. So I will get on my side a victim who's been abused 4 or 5 times, especially younger victims, because the predators will see that they didn't report. And so another predator will then go for them, or they'll go for the victim's friend because, you know, neither of them reported. So it's like they target you by your vulnerability. And so because of that, that's something we also have to consider.
And Ms. Shelley Sicharan, what would you leave us with, your final comment? You can take as much time as you like.
Let me just say, first of all, that I love what Naima is saying there about a victim advocate that can help them navigate the system, because I think very often victims are thrown in and they're sort of left to their own devices to navigate the system. So I think that That is an excellent idea. But before you even ask that question, Kieran, I was writing down here rape prevention, because we're talking about the prosecution of sexual crimes, but very often in the Caribbean, we're not having the discussion we need to have, which is preventing them in the first place. I don't want to be prosecuting these things. I want them to be stopped. And I'll just give you an example. And Naeem is correct to say there are different types of offenders. But I'll give you an example from my own experience involving a young man who was accused of rape. And he was accused of raping a young girl in his social circle, same age and everything, in a circumstance where they were all at a party and they had all been inebriated. And I was the most junior counsel in the case, the most junior person in the case. And I'm hearing all of these older people talk to him, his relatives, other counsel saying, oh, you know, well, she's known to be fast. She's known to be loose. She's no good, basically. And I sat down and I had a conversation with him privately, away from them. And I was explaining the concept of consent. And I was saying to him, I want you to think about it from her perspective. And you were inebriated, she was inebriated. She wakes up the next day and this has happened to her. And she's made a report to the police. You have to consider for a moment that you may have thought it was a consensual encounter, but clearly she did not. And I'm the mother of a young son, and I'm saying that I think we need to be having more and more conversations with our young men about what consent is, what does that look like? This idea that you see a woman on the street and you can just throw talk on at her and she's going to respond to you. We have a society that is very disrespectful of women, and it starts as small as that, throwing talk at a woman in the street and you see she's giggled or she's laughed, but she's laughing quite often because you're humiliating her and she doesn't know how to respond except to defuse the situation. So I think when we talk about rape prevention, let's start with teaching boys about consent, because too often we focus on women and what they can do to protect themselves when we should be having a different conversation. So that would be my response on that question.
You know, I actually saw a movie, I think it was called The Last Duel. It was a very good movie. I don't know if either of you have seen it, but I think it starred Matt Damon and a number of other people. But it did a very good job of showing the different perspectives in a case of, well, it was a case of rape. Mm-hmm. But it showed the different perspectives. It showed the perspective of the person, the perpetrator, who from their perspective felt that they had done absolutely nothing wrong. Whereas from mm-hmm. the other perspectives, it was a very enlightening movie. It was highly entertaining, but highly enlightening at the same time. Anyway, we can end on that note. I want to thank both of our guests for joining us this afternoon.
I'd love to. Thank you.
It really could have been a longer conversation.
But thank you very much.
We were joined, of course.
I'm so glad that we ended on that note. I could just reach through and slap a high five through this radio to my colleague. That was an excellent note to end on, and I'm really glad to hear that.
We were joined by Ms. Naeema Hazel. That's the last voice you just heard there. She's a deputy director of the National Counseling Center in St. Kitts and Nevis. She has over 20 years experience working with youth communities in St. Kitts and Nevis in the areas of health and family life education, guidance and counseling, juvenile justice and NGO development. And we were joined as well by Ms. Shelley Sicharan. She is an attorney at law, a Trinidadian living in Barbados. She has been a lawyer for almost 14 years. She's called to the bar in Trinidad and Tobago, Barbados, Antigua and Barbuda, and Dominica. We thank both of you for joining us this afternoon.